Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. Alrighty. Welcome everybody to the first of our Value Investing live streams. We are proud to present Bill Smead here, founder of Smead Capital Management. The team over at Smead, they are stock market investors. Their clients are individual investors, advisors, family offices, and institutional investors who invest with the firm through its mutual funds, separate accounts, and other investment vehicles. They advise investors that fear stock market failure through low turnover, differentiated, value discipline, seeking great businesses to build wealth. As of some recent days, an update from Monday, the team's portfolio is valued at approximately $1.59 billion across 31 different stocks, with about three new holdings. By weight, some of their top holdings include NVR Incorporated, Target, Amgen, and American Express. As we go through the presentation here, just to keep everybody on the same page, we will allow you to post questions in the chat throughout as we go, but those questions will be held until the very end of the presentation when we jump into our Q&A section with Bill. So without further ado, I'll hand the floor over and we'll jump into things.
Welcome everyone, and thank you for joining us. We're going to run through some what we think are important slides for you to gain historical context to where we are, to understand what is important to us as we examine the circumstances and economics of today as in relation to the way it relates to the eight criteria we have for common stock selection, which of course are the backbone of what we do as portfolio managers. So first, I'm going to jump into history, and I think we'll go ahead and go to the first slide. This is a presentation we have been using just lately called The Lay of the Land. So the first slide is a slide that compares United States large cap equity performance to that of the other developed nations of the world. And it does a pretty good job on a standard deviation basis of showing when things are a bit out of whack. And you can see that actually the go-go 60s, and then again in 1972, the Nifty 50 was the most out of whack episode since 1950. And then we went one standard deviation out of whack in relation to the rest of the developed world in 99-2000. And as you can see, we have taken this particular financial euphoria episode into unknown stratosphere this time. And there's some easy ways of looking at this to help everyone understands. So I think we'll jump to the next slide. These side-by-side slides are mainly designed to show the effect of having the most popular common stocks in the world both be located in the United States as a domicile and then secondarily to be become a massive factor in the S&P 500 index, which, since you're on Guru Focus, most all of you are big fans like us of Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway. And since you're a big fan of Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway, you know that in his four-hour virtual annual meeting, I think he recommended the S&P 500 index for most investors three times. And I found that quite interesting because of the way these two charts show that the FANG stocks have disrupted the market capitalization weighted S&P 500 index. So the way we like to think about it is the S&P 500 index is a common stock portfolio that's available to investors. And it's at its best when it's heavily weighted with things that are about to do extremely well. And it's at its worst when it's heavily weighted with things that are about to do extremely poorly. And this is the leading cause of stock market failure, because most people pile into things that are extremely popular and they flee meritorious things that are extremely unpopular. And we like to buy wonderfully meritorious things that meet our 8 criteria when they're extremely unpopular. And let's go to the next slide. And if going back to 1950 wasn't enough fun for everyone, we'll take you back 215 years. Now, I will mention a conversation I had with my oldest son, who's a co-portfolio manager today. The price of lumber is going wild right now. In fact, on my travels in the last week or two, I've driven by a number of establishments that convert logs and mill lumber into buildable wood. And let me tell you, those businesses are as busy as they ever get, because we woke up in the last 3 or 4 months and realized that 90 million millennials are going to need a house, and they no longer considered a 200-unit apartment in an expensive coastal city loaded with people that have germs to be the proper place to have a home office. So this is 215 years of price action on commodities in the United States. And then the red lines are comparing the way that value investing disciplines trade relative to growth disciplines against that set of commodity statistics. So as you look at the chart, you'll notice that commodities were the most depressed a few months ago, as they have been any time in 215 years. If you're lucky to live past the averages, that's almost 3 lifetimes. So whenever I look at a chart like this, imagine an oil producer when oil hit bottom here a few months ago. Imagine a wildcatter. He's praying, and he's on his knees. He says, "God, I've got two questions for you. The first question is, will the price of oil ever go up again? And if so, when?" And God parts the heavens and speaks to the wildcatter in an audible voice. And he says, "The answer to your first question is yes. And the answer to your second question is not in my lifetime." And when you can buy a meritorious company that meets our 8 criteria for common stock selection, and you're on your knees praying, asking if that will ever happen, that's a pretty good combination of events. So if this chart is telling you something, it is that it's highly likely that commodities will do well in the next 10 years. And then the second thing you get out of this chart is, what would have to happen for that to be the case? And thirdly, you'd have to ask yourself, will the relationship between value and growth be similar to what it has been in the past as that plays out? So I can tell you the first thing you want for commodities to do well is to have a bunch of its production get shut down. So just using oil as an example, what just happened? The Saudi Arabians shut down about 40 or 50% of the oil production in the United States of America. So this reversion of the mean trade is huge. It's huge because it is extremely important to what happens inside the S&P 500 and to value investment disciplines in relation to growth investment disciplines. Let's go to the next chart. Now, I'm a parent of five millennial children, ages 29 to 37. So I have an unusually good laboratory compared to most people. And this chart was given to us about 6 months ago, and Fundstrat did a deep dive and asked the question, what industries would be the most positively impacted by 10 years of aging with the millennial group? And they were ultra generous and even backed out the reduction in baby boomer spending in the same categories. Now, the truth of it is COVID-19 has changed some of the behavior of the boomers. For example, they expected boomers to drastically reduce what they spent on mortgage interest and charges. the people that are 70 and older are not going to move out of their house anytime soon, given what's gone on. So that's changed. So here we are. Mortgage interest and charges, kids apparel, other apparel products and services, footwear, apparel and services, vehicle finance charge, other entertainment supplies, equipment and services, furniture, toys, hobbies, and playground equipment, cell phone service, we'll get back to that, gasoline and motor oil, we'll get back to that, household furnishings and equipment, tobacco products and smoking supplies, vehicle purchase, vehicle rental, leases, licenses, and other charges, maintenance on vehicles and repairs, pets, alcoholic beverages, vehicle insurance, small appliances, and miscellaneous houseware. Okay, we just read through the industries that are highly likely to be most positively impacted by 90 million people getting 10 years older. Now, how much of that list is related to technology? Well, the only thing on this list that is mainly affected by technology is cell phone service. But you know what? It's not on here because they're going to spend 100% more on cell phone service. It's that a whole bunch of 30-year-old men will get off their parents' cell phone bill and start their own cell phone bill. So it's going to double the expense of the millennials to be actually the one paying for their cell phone service. It's not an increase in use of cell phone service. So it's the only of these 20 industries that actually will not be positively impacted, which means there is zero technology-related things on this list. Now, if someone looks at our portfolio, which we will in a few minutes, the June 30 version, you will see that we are loaded to the gills with companies that meet our 8 criteria that will benefit from this list. For example, we have a 16% position in 3 of the 5 largest home builders. NVR is number 5. D.R. Horton is number 1, and Lennar is number 2. And together, we own about 16 to 16.5% of our portfolio in home builders. The S&P 500 has about 45 basis points of their portfolio in home builders. So all of a sudden, you wake up, and germs cause the thing. So in the recent statistics, if you were on Dr. Horton's call or Lennar's call, I think one of them said, it was the people at Dr. Horton told us that the stunning thing of the last 2 or 3 months is the growth in home purchases of people under 34 years old in the last 90 days, which just warmed our heart, literally just warmed our heart. So that's mortgage interest and charges. Now, In the last 15 years, 60% of the college graduates are women. And a disproportionately large percentage of total babies born are being born into above average income households to college educated women. And they buy kids' apparel, and they buy other apparel products and services, and they buy footwear for kids because 6-year-old kids need a new pair of shoes every 90 days because they either outgrow them or they wear them out, one of the two, and apparel and services. Now, if you look at that list, that's number 2 is Target, number 3 is Target, number 4 is Target, and number 5 is Target, and college-educated women shop at Target. For the most part, they avoid Walmart. And if they're in that stage of their life where they've taken time out from their career for 5 years to raise a couple of kids 0 to 5, they do not want that stuff delivered to the house. They want to get in the car, put the kids in the car seats, drive 20 minutes to Target, talk to their mom or their sister or their girlfriend on the phone while the kids sleep for 20 minutes, put them in the cart at Target, wander around for 45 minutes or an hour buying 3 things they need and 3 things they don't, which is where all the profit margins are, and fulfill this list. Get a Starbucks coffee on their way out the door at Target, take them over to McDonald's, put them on the playground, and get home 2.5 hours later. The Wednesday midweek break for sanity will be the big thing of the next 10 years for millennials. I can see Graham, our host, is nodding his head. He's getting ready to live this life himself, and he knows what I'm talking about. The second thing that sticks out on this chart is vehicle finance charge, gasoline and motor oil, vehicle purchases, vehicle rental leases, maintenance and repairs on vehicle, and vehicle insurance. Has anyone noticed on advertising-based television the last 2 or 3 months that we are being inundated with automobile insurance commercials, right? Geico Gecko is back out in force. They're running the humorous, you know, what if you had DJ Callen coach you on brushing your teeth? Jake with State Farm is back in now two, black and white. And wearing khakis. By the way, that's one of my favorite all-time commercials. I'm so glad they brought that commercial back. Flo is out there. We are farmers. Dun, 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 dun. Why are they doing that, folks? Why are they doing that? And the answer is that college-educated women are getting their driver's license now. We've had the most new driver's license the last 5 years in 40 years since the baby boomers got driver's licenses. A very small percentage of people get their license now at 16. More get it at 18, and a lot more are getting it after they decide to move out of the expensive coastal city that has Uber and Lyft, back when they did want to get into a stranger pre-COVID germs. So what that means is auto insurance is going to do well. Selling cars is going to do well. So we own companies that will benefit from this. We had never owned Credit Acceptance Corporation. We had noticed that Sequoia had owned that for a long time, and we took a look at it, and people were panicking because they thought car prices were going to plummet, and they did plummet in March in the panic, in April in the panic. And then a funny thing happened on the way to the forum, and that is all of a sudden everybody thought, wait a second, I need a car. I'm moving to the suburbs. And all of a sudden the price of used cars exploded. They're higher now than they've ever been. And the collateral that Credit Acceptance Corp owns became dramatically more valuable. And 20 million Americans have had their credit rating besmirched by being furloughed or laid off from their job, who suddenly become actually creditworthy people that appear uncreditworthy in the system they've got for measuring creditworthiness. So you see, furniture, all this stuff is household cars. So if you look at this list, this is a list of necessities. And so let me explain to our audience. The stock market successes of the 10 years from 09 to 19 were all about single college educated people making way above average money. Their biggest expense was rent. They were renting from Mr. Potter in It's a Wonderful Life and using 40% of their income renting. But then they had complete discretion over the other 60%, and they spent it going on trips and traveling and robbing from themselves being 55 or 60 someday and wanting something to do. They spent it on Chipotle burritos, craft beer, every new Apple device. In other words, it was all discretionary spending. So every business that depends on discretionary spending among people 25 to 40 is going to get ruined the next 10 years. It's going to become 60% discretionary to 10% discretionary and 90% necessity. I owe, so off to work I go, is going to be the new millennial chant. And the capital in the stock market is completely misallocated right now. So just as one example, we'll go to the next chart. It just compares the price earnings ratio of our portfolio to the S&P. So people say things to us like, Bill, okay, so you think you're going to do a lot better against the S&P than you did in the 10 years ended December 31st. We're pretty proud of the fact that we beat the S&P in the 10 years that finished December 31st, 2019, that decade. We're very proud of that. It was a hard thing to do in the value world, okay? We started out on the left-hand side of this chart. You can see we started out with about a 14% discount in PE to the S&P, and we were spotting the S&P about a 0.5% of dividends. And we beat it net of our annual costs, plus we were spotting them 50 basis points or 0.5% of dividend income at the beginning. Today, we have like a 33% discount on price earnings ratio, not 14%. And they're spotting us a 0.5% in income. This is humorous, so don't take me seriously. If you look up what I just said in the dictionary, it comes under the definition of not a fair fight. So we say we think we're going to We have much more confidence in our ability to beat the index the next 10 years. And then they say things like, what do you think you'll make? And we tell them less than half as much as we made in the 10 years ended December 31st, 2019. Because we think that the index is likely to not make any money other than dividends in the next 10 years. If what is playing out. Now, lastly, you can go to the next chart, which is our holdings, which was at the end of June, and that's changed a lot because there's been a lot of, we've had our share of activity, and also market moves have changed the composition of our portfolio quite a bit since then. But there was a UBS commission study done by the University of Maryland recently that went back to 1963. And as of about 2 weeks ago, value was in the 100th percentile. Now, Graham says, Guru Focus's audience likes numbers and likes mathematics. So I don't have to explain to most of you that when you're in the 100th percentile, it means that only 1% of the last 57 years was this bad. And I think I did the numbers. It's 684 months. So it means there's only been 7 months in the last 684 months that value did this bad against growth. Which means that, for example, if value is 100th percentile in 10 years, you'd beat the index by 5% compounded, or 5% total, counting the compounding. If we're 90th percentile in 10 years, you'll beat it by 28%. And if it reverts to the mean by 10 years from now, and we're just at par, which would be 50th percentile, you'd beat by 68%. And I can't even, I don't even have a calculator that's strong enough to compute what it would be if value goes to like the 10th percentile. And I might be too rich to think about it at that point in time. So we'll just let that go. Okay. Let's just say that I would consider it a blessing from God to be at the 50th percentile in 10 years. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Graham and see if anyone has a question.
All righty. We'll give our chat a little bit of a minute here. But as Bill said, please feel free to post any questions you may have regarding any points of the presentation, or if you just simply want to pick Bill's brain, please let us know anything you're wondering. So far, Bill, it looks like we have some appreciation of the knowledge you have over the 30-year-old women demographic.
Yeah, I have two daughters and two daughter-in-laws. So I have quite a pool there.
Looks like we have a question regarding your criteria for stock selection.
Yeah, you can find that in detail at smeedcap.com. They're primarily qualitative criteria like wide moat, strong balance sheet, long history of profitability, long history of free cash flow generation. We're free cash flow junkies. We like shareholder friendliness. We like strong insider ownership, preferably with recent purchases. We don't have too many timing signals in what we do. One of them is insider buys. For example, Buffett buying more Bank America. That's the kind of thing that gets us charged up. Buffett buying his own stock. We had been calling for him to step on the accelerator there. $5 billion, you know, that's a good start. So those are what our eight criteria. They're things that I picked up from Buffett and John Templeton, Peter Lynch in the 1980s when I started this industry in 1980 as a stockbroker and financial advisor. And by 1991 or two, I had put together these criteria and started selecting stocks based on that. First in separate accounts in the early 90s at Smith Barney. And then we started this company 13 years ago.
Definitely. And it looks like another question here, just asking if you'd be able to repeat how many times value was so disproportionately dispatched from growth over the last 100 years.
Well, that's a really good question. I just saw some charts this week that showed that value stomped growth 1990 to 2000. Value stomped growth 2000 to 2010. 2010 to 2020, growth stomped value. There's a pattern of this, and a lot of it has to do with the strength of the economy. See, I just don't think people realize that the demographic forces coming out of the financial meltdown made for the most anemic economic recovery coming off a deep recession in U.S. history. So let me explain. China was booming in 09, but the United States was coming out of a deep recession. So home building was in a coma in 09 through 15. And I think in 2010, we built 320,000 new homes in the United States. And the low water mark in the prior 60 years with a dramatically smaller population base, right? The population of the United States in 1960 was like 170 million people. The low water mark in the deepest recession of 60s and 70s was 550,000 new homes built. So just, I mean, try to wrap your mind around building 60% less homes than the worst point in the prior 60 years with a population of 315 million people. I mean, literally, home building went off the charts. And we have to give kudos to a guy named Ed Chancellor that was working at Grantham Mayo Van Otterloo at that time. He wrote a piece about why the Chinese housing market was at a top and why the U.S. housing market was at a bottom. This is like in 2012. And we jumped on that and have been working off that ever since. So everybody asks us, we're about the fourth inning of a nine-inning game on housing. It's, you know, we're not at the depths of it. And a lot of people besides us understand that the next 5 to 10 years are going to be great in home building. But that's not stopping those stocks from trading at 10 times earnings. Now, so the answer is, when the economy does well, it has historically been led by houses and cars. And COVID has catalyzed it to be led by houses and cars. Because here's a good one for your audience, a really good axiom to always go by in your investing. Money always goes where it gets traded the best. And right now, renting from Sam Zell in an expensive coastal city is not treating your money well. On an after-tax basis, you can buy a 1,500-square-foot home in 80% of the geography in the United States right now, and after-tax be spending 30-40% less and have nothing but your own germs there. You can have your family over and hide them from your government. And you can eat together.
Definitely. And on the note of food, we have a question here. What do you believe the future for plant food industries are? Do you like BYND or the very good food companies?
I am a terrible person to ask a question like that because we don't own a company. We just have if we don't have 10 years of solid knowledge of a company, we don't invest in it. So I admire people that can figure stuff like that out ahead of time. I used to joke about eBay in the 1999. I tell people, yeah, a guy goes on to eBay and he buys a once used driver for half off, and then he'd go onto his online account and buy 300 shares of eBay, and it would go up 10% the first week he owned it in 99. The guy thought he paid for his driver in the first week he owned the stock. And the stock was trading at, you know, an infinite price earnings multiple because they had no earnings. Well, then I started buying the stock in like 2008. And in Thanksgiving in 2008, the stock's trading at 11. They had $3 a share in cash. They own 30% of Skype. And we're Skyping right now, right? They own 30% of Skype. They had 100% of PayPal. They had 100% of StubHub. They had 100% of the five classified advertising businesses, the largest international online classified advertising businesses in the world, and their e-commerce platform, which, by the way, their e-commerce platform has produced more profit in the last 20 years than the e-commerce side of Amazon on a per-share basis. If you want to look that up, go to Smead blog. When you go to SmeadCap, go to Smead blog and look up the case study we did backing out Amazon Web Services profits the last 7 years from Amazon's profits and determining that in the 20 years ended at the end of 2019, eBay had made arithmetically $25 a share after tax on their e-commerce business, and Amazon had made $23 per share. Now, why eBay is 16 times earnings and Amazon's e-commerce business, if you split out AWS, is trading at about, you know, 210 times earnings, even though it's been way less profitable, I have no idea. But that's a separate subject. So the answer to Beyond Meat is, how many years have we known to eat our broccoli? And the answer is, we've known that for decades. What percentage of people eat their broccoli? 10. I'm guessing 10%. I'm one of them. I like broccoli. I eat a lot of broccoli. Okay? Okay. How many people set out to get really good physical condition by going to the athletic club or getting on a Peloton? How many people try that at some point in time? The answer is, a huge percentage of people try that. And how many people are still doing it 10 years later? Maybe about 10%. Okay, so as a general rule, when it comes to people doing healthy things, you are not going to get rich on people doing healthy things. But there are some people we know that are familiar to you, guru focus folks, like Russo and others, and they own sin stocks. They own tobacco companies, alcohol companies. They own the companies that physically harm the bodies of their best customers, but they're addicted to, and that is what makes people wealthy. Now, we just have, it's an unwritten, unprospective rule in our business. I spent 10 years trying to convince my mom to quit smoking when she was alive, to no avail. And I just decided I do not want to sell cigarettes to somebody else's mom. I wanted her to quit that so bad. So there are certain things that we're never going to own. It's not in the prospectus. But I can tell you that is a profitable way to invest. That is anything addictive that works. Anything that seems to be healthy and the right thing for people, as a general rule, I wouldn't bet on over 20 years.
Definitely. And looks like we have a question. What's your view on the value of the U.S. dollar over the next 10 years and potentially your view on gold as well?
Again, we try not to get into too much macroeconomics, but based on that commodity chart, I think the dollar is going to stink. Commodity is going to do great. Inflation is going to become a factor. Interest rates are going to go up, and our bank stocks and our energy stuff and our property ownership, it's just crazy. You can buy real estate and oil in the ground. You can speculate better on the New York Stock Exchange right now in inflation oriented things than you probably could since 1966, I'd guess, based on those charts. Yeah, the answer is we like owning companies that are involved in it, that own a lot of buildable lots. We like owning the mall REITs because they own incredibly attractive property in the very attractive places in the United States. We like owning Chevron. We like our bank stocks. Basically, all the list of things that aren't doing well today are things that will benefit from the inflation that comes from 90 million millennials buying houses and cars and borrowing money in a world where the federal government just shoved $4 trillion of newly printed money.
For sure.
But how do I really feel?
And within a portfolio, do you think there's an absolute bare minimum of stocks required to actually see success?
Well, we're big fans of Charlie Munger. We settled on 25 to 30 securities maximum. And typically about half of our portfolio is in the top 10. So we're kind of in the Charlie Munger camp there. Especially, you know, we've had the most activity this year that we've had since 08. What caused 08 to give us activity is we did two upgrades. You know, people would call me in late 08, early 09, say, Bill, what do you think of Ford here? And what do you think of Washington Mutual here, right? And I'd say, okay, let's stop here for a second. I can buy Starbucks at that point at 10, which, by the way, is an addiction that doesn't kill people. I can buy Starbucks at 10, and I have a good chance of making 10 times my money on that stock here. Or I could buy Ford, and there's a pretty good chance of making 10 times your money on Ford, but there's some significant chance that they're going out of business. This is exactly the exercise that Buffett was going through on the airlines, right? And he's thinking, okay, there's too much chance that they could go out of business, and there's just as much chance that I can make 10 times my money on Berkshire Hathaway or Bank of America, hence what he's doing with his money, okay? And that's a big factor. You want to look for your 10 baggers out of things that aren't in the group of things that could go out of business, in our opinion.
Definitely. Looks like we have one here looking at Target. The questionnaire doesn't really see Target as a value, but more on the growth side of things. Are you relying on PEG ratios for that?
That is a really good question because it puts me into one of my favorite subjects. Okay. So I'll have to apologize. That is a relative value proposition. Okay. So track with me, and we've written about this too. Every staple company that can walk and talk and chew gum, like Pepsi, Coke, Costco, Visa, MasterCard. That's a long list. If they're involved in growth funds, growth ETFs, and are a big part of the S&P, they all trade at 35 times earnings. So here's Target at 18 times earnings or wherever it is, with unbelievable leverage on what millennials are going to do in their life the next 10 years, right? Unbelievable leverage. Are the millennials going to drink a lot more Coca-Cola? No. Are they going to go to Costco a lot more than they are now? The answer is they can't. There's no more room in there. Okay. But the bottom line is we argue that Costco and Target are likely to both grow about 10% a year in earnings the next 10 years. But you pay 35 times to buy Costco and you buy 18 times to buy Target. That's value. We're going to get twice as much stock market success and avoid stock market failure because we don't have to worry about Costco's P ratio contracting to what it should be, which is closer to 20. Now, there's lots of other bad examples that are worse than Costco.
For sure. So, next question here. Do you think banks, insurance, and industrials are much, much better opportunities now, or will we see a rotation to the mean?
Well, them doing a lot better is the only way you can revert to the mean. Hey, you know, Wells Fargo and Bank America were getting pretty close to how they traded in the bottom in 08 for the next 3 years when Occupy Wall Street was the set of looters that were out there. we've got a new set of looters now. But by the way, it's probably a bad humor, but what I noticed is even looters know where to shop. You know, when they're breaking windows and walking out with $1,000 handbags, it seems like they know where to shop.
For sure.
So the answer is, it's hard for us to buy industrials, but they're likely to do well. Because let's face it, if people buy houses and cars, see, our home builders are probably counted as consumer discretionary, which is ridiculous. They're basically home manufacturers, right? They're industrial companies. So we're overloaded with home builders, and that's industrial companies. And the next 10 years is, I think home building is likely to be the best industry in the United States the next 10 years. And then how do you get a house? Well, you borrow money. What happens to the price of money when 90 million millennials all want to borrow money at the same time? It goes up. And the bank's spreads get a lot better. It's not very – by the way, the banks did really well in the 60s in a situation like this. And by the way, one of our favorite sayings in all of our work is, when everyone knows that something is so, nobody knows nothing. And that came from the guy that ran Intel, Andy Grove, when asked in Fortune magazine 15 years ago the best business advice he ever got. And that was his professor at the City College of New York said, when everyone knows that something is so, nobody knows nothing. So does anybody not know that it's healthier to eat a plant-based hamburger? I don't think anybody doesn't know that. The problem is the COVID misery stocks have what everybody knows. I'm guessing people are using the most technology in their life right now that they will use in their life anytime in the next 10 years. And say goodbye to the 120 multiples and the 80 multiples. Because RCA wasn't worth that in 1929. And Cisco wasn't worth that in 1999, 2000. And none of it ends up being worth it. Because the money always goes where it's getting treated the best.
For sure. So in this world that we all exist in, learning about investment and so forth, we hear a lot about moats and economic moats for businesses to find success. Where do you personally go to find information to help you make those type of assessments?
Well, 40 years in the investment business teaches you what you need to know about moats. The best moats are basically intangible and intellectual in nature. They're not measurable. Morningstar has done a lot of good things over the years, but they do some, in my opinion, stupid things. And one of the worst things they've done is trying to create a mathematical model out of a moat. There's nothing mathematical about the fact that if you've trained your palate to like the taste of Starbucks, that you're addicted, that's a moat. Or to Coca-Cola, and that's a moat. What's that got to do with mathematics? If your mom takes you to Starbucks when she goes to get her coffee and she buys you a hot chocolate between the ages of 5 and 10, what are you going to do when you're a mom? If you went to Disneyland and you love Disneyland and you take your kids to Disneyland, what are your kids going to do when they get kids? There's no mathematical model for that. And that's been a big mistake. I'll just tell you, it's been a big mistake, in my opinion. Now, you segued into one of my favorite topics. When you have a monopolistic moat that can damage the rest of our economy, you got a problem. And I'm telling you, go back and rewatch Dennis Cicilline's opening statement when they interviewed the leaders of the four biggest tech organizations, and he is spot on. Those are utilities. They're utilities, and they're going to get regulated like utilities and broken up like utilities. And when that AWS gets separated from that e-commerce building business, people are going to realize how much more profitable being the New York Stock Exchange of e-commerce, which is eBay, and not being the Federal Express, UPS, Whole Foods mess. And that's all it is delivering low margin products in a very expensive way. Kroger makes 1.5% profit on groceries. How do you spend $5 a delivery making money on a $50 bag of groceries that has 75 cents margin in it? In the grocery industry, they've had a joke about those weekly advertisements they ran on Wednesday or Thursday in the newspaper, and they had lost leaders, right, that people would buy. And they'd always say, yeah, we're losing on that at that price, but we're going to make it up on volume. People have been telling me for the last 10 years that Amazon was going to make it up on volume. But when they reported their first quarter earnings, Bezos said they were going to spend $4 billion cleaning up the mess. And Charlie Munger says a business that constantly has to plow a lot of the money that's made back into the business is not the kind of business we want to own. But AWS is the kind of business that Charlie wants to own. The problem is if you separate those two, it's going to, you might find out that one of the emperors might not wear clothes. Or when the tide goes out, you might find out who's swimming naked. But the biggest problem those companies have is they've been given away. Amazon has given away delivery. Facebook gave away social media, and Google gave away search. And so what they're doing is they're making their money from the control they have of people and by blocking any possibility of competition. And the problem is they are AT&T, they are Standard Oil in 1906. They're too important already to the existence of the economy, and that is going to make a mess of the S&P 500 when they have to deal with it. Now, that might not be for 3 or 4 years. So, as I say very often, you can't hold your breath till then.
For sure. And as we get into our last couple of questions here, Bill, a lot of times we talk exhaustively about buying a stock, but what would you say are your primary considerations to actually go the opposite and sell off something?
Right. Most of our selling is asking, where are we wrong? We buy a stock, we might own it for 3 years, and we might decide that it's just not something we're ever going to make money on. By the way, I wrote a piece a month or two or three ago about ones that I gave up on that did really well. But for every three of those, there's 20 that it was a good decision. So most of our selling is taking capital out of things that have not contributed alpha over long stretches of time. On the positive side, we will sell a successful investment if the stock gets maniacal, which to us is twice as high a P/E ratio of the average of the prior 5 to 10 years. So if we bought a stock at 20 times earnings and we wake up at 40 times earnings, we'll sell it. We received one share of PayPal for every share of eBay, and we've spent the last couple of years selling those shares. We should have waited till now, but we did. People do not pay us to try to determine if a 50 multiple stock is going to keep its multiple. That's not what they pay us for. Of course, we believe that 50 multiple stocks won't keep their multiple, that they'll all go to 20, which means somewhere along the line, you got to lose your multiple. And if you're involved in those stocks, when they go from a 50 to a 20 multiple, you don't survive it. Cisco and Intel are below where they were 20 years ago. So yes, we'll sell a winning position when it just gets too popular. That's really hard. We hold our winners to a fault. That's one of the things that differentiates us from other value managers. A lot of value managers say, I want to buy a 50-cent dog. It gets to 90 cents, I'm selling. Well, with companies, that 90 cents can be a moving target. It has been with Target.
For sure. And we'll try and crank through our last couple of questions here pretty fast, since we're getting a little bit slim on time. So we might not necessarily be able to go as in-depth with them. But getting onto these last few, it looks like we have a couple questions regarding some of your picks, specifically your process in actually valuing a business. Would you like to briefly give us a kind of overview on that?
Well, we, as a backup to our A criteria, we use the kind of back of the envelope Graham model, you know, kind of the 12-month earnings multiplied by 2 times what we think the 10-year growth rate will be, plus 8.5, which was the multiple that Graham determined a stock should trade out if the earnings were going to be flat for 10 years. And then he used 4.4 divided by the AAA 10-year bond rate. And we haven't changed. We use 5.5, even though the AAA bond rate on 10 years is way below that. And so we come up with an intrinsic value on the back of the envelope just to kind of back up what we're doing. And that has served us well. It's created a very high margin of safety for us on things.
For sure. And do you have any thoughts on the concept of dollar cost averaging when investing in a stock?
We kind of do. We're big fans of that with our mutual fund. A lot of times I got friends and relatives, and I run into them and, hey, I just came into a bunch of money. Should I buy your fund? And I say, I'm a big fan of dollar cost averaging because you don't want to do lousy in the first year and a half you're involved and not be around for 10 or 20 years, because that's how you defeat stock market failure, is to own a meritorious discipline for a long time. And so I'm a fan of dollar cost averaging.
Definitely. And one of our questionnaires here looks like they noticed some lightness in your consumer defensive holdings in that portfolio that we showed. What would be your perspective on the sector?
The reason for that is because Walgreens didn't buy Ulta when they could have. And we owned Walgreens and we owned AmerisourceBergen. But with everything that's happened through COVID-19 and all the bargains that were created in things related to commodities and buying property, for example, we own U-Haul and they own a massive amount of property all over the United States that's held at cost on their balance sheet. So where was I? I'm sorry, I lost track of your question.
Looking at consumer defensive holdings.
Yeah, so we used to have a lot more in consumer defensive. We had Kroger. The insiders never bought that stock in the low to mid 20s. And really, if COVID-19 hadn't come along, that stock would have been a dud. We had Walgreens, and Walgreens just hasn't been selling enough makeup.
For sure. And getting down to our We'll call it our last two here. Unfortunately, we won't be able to answer all of them just based upon our time restraints, but we'll get pretty close. With something like Simon Properties and malls shutting down and the younger generation buying things online, our audience just would like your thoughts on that trend as a whole, or if you even see it as a trend.
Quick story. By the time I was a sophomore in high school, I'd have like four classes each semester, and one of them was stimulating to me and the other three weren't. But I never got up each day and wasn't excited about going to high school, because the school had a moat in our town. And the moat was that every 16 to 18 year old girl was required by law to show up there 180 days a year. So I was anxious to go there. Where are 15 to 25 year old people going to go to gather? That's all you need to know. When this is over, they're going to gather. That's all you need to know. And these guys have the financial muscle to get. We love having our money in bed with great wealth creating individuals. And David Simon and his family are absolutely great wealth producing individuals. That's the kind of bunker I want to be in a war.
Definitely. And to get to our final question here, as we're dwindling on time, one that I appreciate and would love to hear the answer to. Over your career, obviously decades in the industry, plenty of experience, what has been your biggest mistake, and what have you put in place to prevent yourself from repeating it?
That's easy. It's the same thing that Buffett, I answer this question the same way Buffett does. When you buy a stock at 30, what's the worst thing that can happen to you? You can lose 30. You can lose 100% of your investment. What's the best thing that can happen to you? It's unlimited. All my biggest mistakes I've already mentioned in this talk, which was things I bought, held for 3 or 4 years, they weren't working, it wasn't working, got out of them, and then they ended up going up 10 or 20 or 30 times what I paid for them. We had, in 08, we had 8% of our portfolio in Microsoft, and by 2011, I was sick of Steve Ballmer wasting my money, and we sold it. I paid 22 and a half to buy it. We sold it at 28 and a half, and it's been going up ever since. So the worst mistake I've ever made was owning a company that had a board of directors that didn't know to get rid of that guy sooner. He wasted more money in a 10-year stretch than anybody in the history of publicly traded chief executive officers. And cost me a 10-bagger.
For sure. Well, throughout our chat, Bill, we have a lot of comments, I'll say. Just an appreciation of you coming out here and giving this speech today. And on behalf of Guru Focus, I'd like to thank you for coming out and kicking things off for us and being a great first guest.
Well, thanks for having us. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And before we take off here, I just open the floor. Any final comments or anything that we didn't hit on before we take off?
SmeedCap.com would be my final comment. We view our job as to stop people from running into stock market failure.
Once again, Bill, thank you for joining us today. It was an absolute pleasure, and we hope to potentially have you back in the future for more.
Thanks a lot.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.